Nuri al-Maliki became prime minister of Iraq in 2006 at a time when sectarian violence came close to ripping his country apart. Since then, he's tightened his grip on power in ways that some critics see as all too similar to Saddam Hussein's. Joining us now is Michael Peel, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. Very pleased to welcome you back to today's backstory segment. Hello, Michael.
Hi there. Thank you very much.
You're in the United Arab Emirates right now?
That's right, yeah.
How far is that from Iraq?
In terms of distance, I'm not sure, but it's a few hours on the plane, about 2.5-3 hours.
And another world.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely.
You write that, I'm quoting, on paper, free Iraq is a vibrant democracy with a government whose diversity ought to be the envy of many in the region. But what's the reality?
Well, there's a real paradox at the heart of Iraqi politics, because on the one hand, you have this Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, whose party only has less than a third of the seats in the parliament, and yet, even given that he doesn't have this parliamentary majority, he's managed to concentrate, say his critics, an enormous amount of power. He's the commander-in-chief for the country. He holds the defense and interior ministry portfolios. And he also has, say, analysts, a real command of the security services. Over the past few years, he's worked at getting real loyalists into top positions. And so his critics say he's really, despite the fact that in the terms of the parliamentary arithmetic, he doesn't have the power, that what he's managed to do very successfully is to capture a lot of key institutions of the state, particularly security institutions. And some people say, well, this is the kind of way in which Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party operated. Now, Mr. al-Maliki himself says, you know, this is rubbish. He spoke at a press conference just before the departure of U.S. troops in December with President Obama. He said Iraq was a much freer country. It was democratic. It observed the constitution, which was drawn up during the U.S. occupation. And his allies say, one of his allies, an MP who's quite a close ally of his, said, look, it's ridiculous. There are all kinds of checks and balances in the system to appoint various advisors, to do all kinds of things in government. He has to have approval of either the cabinet or the parliament. So it's just a ridiculous and offensive exaggeration to say that he's somehow turning the country into a dictatorship again. But it is fair to say that it's not only his political opponents, but a lot of analysts and diplomats do point to the fact that he has what they say are very autocratic tendencies, and that this is something that really Iraq is going to have to wrestle with as it goes forward and tries to reinsert itself as an independent country after the U.S. occupation.
And he later will talk about the situation with the Sunni opposition leader, the vice president, in fact, Tariq al-Hashemi. But you note that al-Maliki has thrived while his opponents have self-destructed. Now, why have they self-destructed? Did he help them self-destruct?
Yeah, people, you know, they give him credit that he's a good politician, or as one analyst, Toby Dodge of the London School of Economics, says, you know, an excellent politician, if a Machiavellian one. And his opponents just haven't been able to match that political skill. So, for example, one of the other political groups, Iraqiya, actually won more seats in the parliament than his own Mr. Maliki's own state of law grouping, but they weren't able to turn that into a meaningful hold on power. And basically, his opponents have been wrong-footed at various key times. So Iraqiya had a walkout a few months ago in protest at the way the government was being run. But then they came running back and managed to look weak. So rather than being a demonstration of strength and asserting themselves, they had to reverse their position, and that strengthened Mr. Maliki and made them look weaker. But more broadly, what the situation reflects is the real mosaic that is Iraqi politics. You have a situation where there is Mr. Maliki's group, Iraqiya, there's a Shia-based party led by Muqtada al-Sadr, a firebrand cleric, and then there's also the Kurdish group, and of course Kurdistan is now a semi-autonomous part of Iraq. And so all of these different groups are jockeying for position. And one of the real worries is that Iraqi politics, by its nature, and especially because of what has happened both during the Saddam era and during the U.S. occupation, where it was in a state of basically sectarian civil war for several years, what this has done is that it's given politics a real sectarian feel. So Mr. Maliki is Shia, and he heads a Shia grouping, basically, and that these that the tensions between this grouping, the other Shia groups, and the Sunni minority in Iraq, which of course is where Saddam Hussein came from, are growing increasingly. And of course, at the heart of this is what you mentioned a few minutes ago, which is the face-off between Mr. Maliki and some of the top Sunni politicians who have basically been targeted since the end of the U.S. occupation. And the most notable example of that is the Deputy President Tariq al-Hashimi. A warrant, days after the U.S. left, a warrant was issued for his arrest on terrorism charges, which he denies.
It sounds like Ukraine. It sounds like what's happened in Ukraine.
Well, I think the thing about this is that the it's quite clear that a lot of very bad things, as we know, happened during this period of 2006 to 2008, when the sectarian conflict in Iraq was at its peak. There were Sunni militias, there were Shia militias, which were very active and doing very bad things. And I think everyone would say that there are lots of people in Iraq who these things have never been investigated properly, and there are all sorts of people who should be held to account and have not been for various reasons. So whatever the rights and wrongs of Mr. Hashimi's case, the fact that there has not been a proper accounting for what happened during the war, I think, is uncontroversial. But, of course, the problem with pursuing Mr. Hashimi like this is, whatever the merits of the case, it looks extremely political. Mr. Hashimi himself says, this is Mr. Maliki is behind this. He's trumped up these charges to pursue me and persecute me. And, of course, the timing does not look good, because this came up within days of the U.S. leaving. It looks like Mr. Maliki asserting his power. He insisted it's not. It's a legal process, and it's an independent legal process. But the timing, of course, leads many observers to say, actually, this is more about politics than a real attempt to hold people to account.
And Mr. Hashimi is currently in exile in Turkey, where the government shows no sign of a willingness to turn him over to the Iraqis. Is that also a Sunni-Shia thing?
Well, the position of Turkey is very interesting, and Iraq, the relationship between Baghdad and Ankara have really deteriorated recently, and there's been a war of words between Mr. Maliki Mr. Erdogan, the leader of Turkey. And Mr. Maliki, I think, recently declared Turkey a hostile state. And yes, there is the Sunni connection. There's also an interesting connection where Turkey has good relations with the Kurdish region in Iraq, a lot of business relationships there, particularly commercial relationships. But at the same time, it's a very delicate balancing act for Turkey, because it doesn't want to see an independent, a fully independent Kurdistan in Iraq, because it's worried then that its own Kurdish population will feel they will start to press even harder for their own independent state. So Ankara is in a difficult position. It has a lot of interest to balance. And of course, it also has the conflict in Syria going on, and that plays into all of this because of some of the sectarian elements of that. And so basically in that little sub-region around Turkey, Iraq, Syria, there are all kinds of political tensions at the moment which are playing out at the very highest level, at a head of state level. And then, of course, you feed into that also the relationships between Iraq and Iran, which obviously are a lot better now than, to put it mildly, than they were under Saddam Hussein. Under Saddam Hussein, as you know, Iraq and Iran fought a brutal war. Now, with Mr. Maliki there, he's a Shia. The regime in Iran also is a Shia, and Mr. Maliki actually lived in Tehran for a while when he was in exile under the Saddam regime. So there's this delicate question of how close is Iraq to Iran. People say yes, they are close. It's obviously a relationship that works for both of them. But on the other hand, for some of the reasons that I was talking about in my article, Mr. Maliki is very interested in building his own power base, say analysts, and so he wants to preserve a degree of independence from everyone, and that includes Iran. But we're seeing Iraq's regional importance growing, and the fact that it's tried to preserve these relationships with Iran, but also with the United States and the wider Western world, and indeed the next round of nuclear talks on Iran's nuclear program will be in Baghdad later this month, which is a reflection of, you know, Iraq's position. It might say as a sort of bridge, perhaps, between, you know, Iran and the wider world. Others might put it a bit more cynically and say that Iraq is opportunistic. It will swing one way or the other according to how it sees its interests. But it clearly is now reasserting itself on the regional and indeed international scale.
You mentioned Muqtada al-Sadr earlier, the Shiite religious leader who has his own army. Has he been in support of Mr. Maliki, or does he see him as a rival within the Shiite community?
Well, that's a very interesting and a crucial question. Mr. Sadr is a key supporter of Mr. Maliki, and I think a lot of respected analysts say, you know, as long as Muqtada al-Sadr is behind Mr. Maliki, he'll probably be able to stay in power and his government will not be threatened. But although they're both Shia, they're, as you say, they're not necessarily natural friends. There are rivalries there. Muqtada al-Sadr, people say, went into the coalition with Mr. Maliki under Iranian pressure, and this is one reason why Mr. Maliki does owe Tehran a debt. Mr. Sadr's position has become more interesting. He actually has started to speak out a bit more. He's met with other opponents of Mr. Maliki who are accusing the prime minister of autocratic behavior, and indeed he signed a letter to this effect, which was published in an Iraqi state newspaper over this weekend just gone, in which he and other leaders, including Iyad Alawi of Iraqiya, threatened a vote of no confidence in the government if it didn't stop what they called its autocratic decision making. So there's a sense in which things seem to be building to a head, but a lot of people still doubt whether Mr. Maliki's opponents, and in particular Muqtada al-Sadr, would would go as far as pulling the plug on his government, trying to bring it down and prompting a fresh political turmoil, political chaos that in the end might not profit them either.
My guest on this backstory look at the situation, Nouri al-Maliki, as ruler of Iraq, despite the fact that his party has fewer than one-third of the seats in the parliament, is Michael Peel, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. This is the author of an article on this very situation in, what was it, Tuesday paper. This is WNYC, yeah. WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Michael?
Yes.
You were talking and I interrupted you.
No. You just said, was it Monday or Tuesday? I couldn't remember myself. But
yeah, it was Tuesday.
I think it was Tuesday.
Now, Mr. Yeah. Maliki lived in Tehran and Damascus while he was in exile, which would suggest mm-hmm. that he should have good relations with Iran, as you discussed earlier. What about Syria and the troubled situation in Syria? Syria shares a long border with Iraq, and many Iraqis went into exile in Syria during the worst days of turmoil. Are relations between Syria and Iraq good?
Well, they're certainly not bad, and Mr. Maliki is certainly not on board with the rhetoric that comes from the West, or indeed some of the Gulf countries on Iraq, the rhetoric against President Bashar al-Assad's regime, and he's certainly not on board with any plans to arm the Syrian, the armed part of the Syrian opposition, which leaders in Qatar and Saudi Arabia have both said they favor. This is where Iran comes in again. Syria clearly is a very important ally of Iran in the Arab world, and there is that religious affiliation between religious connection between Tehran and Damascus, but also Baghdad and Damascus. President Bashar al-Assad is from the Alawite minority religious group, which is an offshoot of Shia Islam, so an offshoot of the party of Islam, followed by Mr. Maliki and the leaders in Tehran. And you can see that there are connections there. Last summer it was announced there were some plans for a gas pipeline to be run from Iran to Syria via Iraq, and that there's clearly a kind of connection between those three countries, and Iraq is a natural bridge geographically as well as politically between Iran and Syria. But on the other hand, and this reflects some of the complexities that there are in Iraqi politics at the moment, Mr. Maliki, Western officials say, has cooperated on attempts to stop what the West suspects are attempts to fly arms from Iran to Syria via Iraqi airspace. And also, Mr. Maliki, many analysts say, must be very acutely aware that Syria is an important bulwark for him, in that if the Assad regime were to fall, then Iran would be looking for another chief ally in the Arab world, and the obvious choice would be Mr. Maliki. So he has an interest, in one sense, in the Assad regime surviving for his own benefit, because he, for all of his links with Iran, most people think he doesn't want to become a straightforward client state, a straightforward puppet of Iran, which is the danger for him should the Assad regime fall, and Tehran is looking to make him that kind of an ally as a result. So the survival of the Assad regime, many analysts would say the political calculation for Mr. Maliki is that that's good for him, because that gives him a little bit of leeway, a little bit of breathing space to be a bit more independent in his foreign policy of Tehran.
Has he taken a position on Tehran's nuclear ambitions and the role Israel might play in trying to stop that?
He hasn't been particularly outspoken on this, and I think he's the kind of man who, when he can, will play a cautious hand until he's forced to put his cards on the table. And I think that's reflected in the fact that the Western powers, they might not have particularly liked the idea of having these talks in Baghdad, but they were prepared to accept it. And he's been careful to preserve relations with the United States, which is also in his interest from a security point of view as well, of course, and not to completely alienate them. So, but it'll be very interesting to see what his rhetoric is in the run-up to this meeting and during this meeting, and whether he tries to use that platform to assert himself and to set out Iraq's position, not just on the Iranian nuclear program, but on its wider regional and international foreign policy.
Now, your article is called Iraq's Singular Ambition, which suggests that despite his denial of a desire to tighten his grip on power, he actually is. And you point out that there are large billboards featuring his picture all posted all around Iraq, which would remind people of what Saddam used to do.
Yes, I mean, I think it's from the parts of Iraq I've seen, it certainly hasn't got to the Saddam levels yet. I mean, I didn't actually visit Iraq during the Saddam regime, but from everything I've read and seen, I would think, you know, to be fair, it certainly hasn't reached those levels. But I think the point the person I quoted in the article was making was that you know, this guy, you know, he's not a Saddam figure, he's not a Colonel Gaddafi kind of figure, i.e., you know, a dictator who doesn't even make a pretense of having any kind of elected mandate. He is a prime minister, an elected prime minister in a constitutional democracy, and indeed one who, as we discussed, has a minority of parliamentary seats. So it's pretty strange for such a figure to, you know, have his have such iconography, to have his face on billboards, particularly alongside, you know, holy figures like Imam Hussein, and the example I quoted from the Shia faith. Now, whether or not he actually instigates all or any of these posters being put up, and he may well have nothing to do with it, it's more a point about the broader culture that exemplifies. And, you know, as the person I quoted said, that you know, once you see faces of a leader, elected leader, appearing in this way on traffic circles and roads and all the rest of it, that does set certain alarm bells ringing, especially in a country like Iraq, which has only just emerged from the period of Saddam's dictatorship.
Now, Michael Rubin recently wrote in Commentary magazine, "True, Maliki is consolidating power, but any competent leader in Iraq would," which seems to suggest that only a strong man can run Iraq. And you quote a Western diplomat as saying of Mr. Maliki, "What's the alternative?" Is there a fear that if he left, we would see a worse situation in Iraq?
Well, I think that's certainly one of the drivers of Western policy towards him, which is that, you know, they don't particularly have an affinity with him in terms of his religious and political background. But at the same time, they fear that the alternatives might be worse. I mean, Iraq is a Shia majority country, so the calculation is if there was a replacement, worse, I mean, from their point of view, Iraq is a Shia majority country, so the calculation is that if Mr. Maliki were replaced, it would be by another Shia leader who might be someone who the West would find more hardline and more unpalatable. So, so what that diplomat said, I think, really goes to the heart of the Western calculation on Iraq, and you know, is one of the reasons why Mr. Maliki is almost acquiring this power you know, by default, in this, despite his parliamentary weakness. There are various circumstances, various stars which have aligned in his favor, and that is one of them.
Well, we've seen protests throughout the Arab world, Egypt, Tunisia, Syria, the Emirates, Lebanon, Jordan. Have we seen much in Iraq? Is there, have people, we were talking earlier about a possible no confidence vote in Parliament, but have we seen any sense that the public has no confidence in this government?
Well, that's an interesting question because about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, and when in the early days when the Bin Shinazir and Egypt and trouble was kicking off in Yemen, Syria, Libya, and so forth. There were demonstrations in Iraq. Indeed, Baghdad has its own Tahrir Square, there were protests there. I spoke to some people who'd attended those protests. They said, there was a very heavy security presence security force clampdown meant that those protests pretty much fizzled out. And I think the interesting question is whether those will recur. On the one hand, politically, there is a constitutional democracy in place, so that removes the kind of dictatorship element of protest that we've seen across this region, across the Middle East. People who were writing about this at the time were saying one of the big drivers in Iraq was people were very unhappy with the economy and the lack of basic services. Electricity in Baghdad is, people say, is still off for many hours a day, very unreliable. This is now almost 10 years after the U.S. invasion. Those grievances hadn't gone away, but I think, again, possibly it's a combination of perhaps a fear of the security forces, but also the same sense that we were talking about of, well, what exactly would we be protesting for? What is the kind of change that these kind of protests could precipitate? And that's something that people perhaps are also thinking about. But, those protests did happen, and it's possible that they could be revived, especially if the political situation starts to seriously deteriorate.
Michael, just one more question. Maliki has resisted pressure from Washington to extend a U.S. presence in his country. Does he need to appear to be antagonistic to the United States in order to maintain domestic political legitimacy and not be seen as an American patsy?
I think he definitely needs not to be seen as an American patsy. I think he would hesitate for his own political reasons to be too confrontational about it, because there'll be no more meetings like the one in Baghdad this month if he is, and he craves that kind of international recognition and international legitimacy, and of course, in one sense, like other Iraqi politicians, he's trying to reinvent the country as an independent state, finally freed of both dictatorship and outside foreign military occupation. I don't think people right now see him likely to take a radically different course in his policy towards the U.S., but this is such a volatile region for all of the reasons we've discussed. And if there is a big change vis-a-vis the West and Iran, or a big change in Syria, or some other game changer, then that could throw those calculations up in the air, and he might decide to pursue a different course regarding Washington, or Washington a different course with him. But at the moment, it's a status quo which it might not be to anybody's taste on either side particularly, but it's one both sides have decided they can live with for now.
Michael Peel is a Middle East correspondent for Financial Times. We have a link to his article, Iraq's Singular Ambition, on our show page at WNYC.org. And Michael, thank you so much, Michael Peel, for being our guest on today's Backstory segment.
Thank you very much.